Good day. Today is Thursday, 19th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched or listened to this programme, you decide that you like what you have seen and heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, I say without any hesitation that yesterday and today were the most momentous, the most consequential, the most important in the conflict in Iran, which we have seen up to now. And I'm going to suggest that the first event in the sequence of events that have played out actually took place a few days previously, and that is the Israeli attack that killed the head of Iran's National Security Council, Ali Larijani, and supposedly a large number of civilians in the apartment building in which some members of his family and his bodyguards were located. I'm not going to say that I know the exact facts, but those are the reports that are appearing in Iran. Anyway, that set the sequence of events which followed. Then, subsequent to that attack, which I've already discussed extensively and I'm not going to discuss further, subsequent to that attack, there was two Israeli attacks on important economic targets in Iran. One, which is the attack on Iran's giant South Pars gas field, has received enormous international attention. The second, which is an attack on the Bushehr nuclear power plant in a different part of Iran, has received, as far as I can see in the international media, almost no attention at all, which I find astonishing, given the way in which people in the course of the conflict in Ukraine have repeatedly spoken out against attacks on nuclear power plants. The Russians have been repeatedly warned not to attack Ukraine's nuclear power plants, and there is no record that up to now they have done so directly, just to say. Anyway, there was this attack on the Bushehr nuclear power plant. It appears that no significant damage was done. I am not sure exactly which facility in the nuclear power plant itself was attacked. Perhaps it was not one of the main buildings. But there is another important fact about the Bushehr nuclear power plant, and that is that it was partly built by the Russians, and that there is a large number of technicians from Russia working for Russia's Rosatom state nuclear power monopoly, that there was a large number of these technicians present at the nuclear power plant. Now, just briefly, I'd received a report about a week ago that the United States has been extremely careful through a military liaison officer at the US Embassy in Moscow to inform the Russians when attacks take place against facilities where Russian civilians are expected or believed to be present. There are no such warnings given in relation to Iranian facilities where Russian military personnel might be present, but at any rate, when it comes to civilians, the Americans generally warn the Russians about such attacks, but it seems that no such warning was given in advance of the attack on the nuclear power plant in Bushehr. There are no reports that any Russian technician has actually been injured or killed in this strike. There's been strong criticisms of this attack in Moscow from the Russian government. But as I said, the international media have said virtually nothing about it. The Russian authorities are warning that a direct strike on the nuclear power plant at Bushehr, which might cause significant damage to that nuclear power plant, might cause, well, unfathomably vast catastrophic consequences. I'm not a nuclear power engineer. I don't propose to discuss or speculate about that further. The other strike, however, the strike against the South Pars gas field, has received massive international attention. Now, at this point, I think I would just say a few things about the geography. South Pars is the largest known gas field from which natural gas is extracted in the world, and it extends through the Persian Gulf to Qatar. Qatar also exploits the same natural gas field. It's obviously not called South Pars in Qatar, but we are looking at a single big gas field that stretches through Iran, goes under the Persian Gulf, includes Qatar itself, and Qatar obviously has been the third biggest producer of natural gas and one of the major players in the liquefied natural gas industry. Now, the key thing to understand is that these are both civilian facilities. Both Bushehr and South Pars are civilian facilities. South Pars provides Iran with its natural gas, and it also is used, the gas from South Pars is also used by Iran to generate electricity, which is the electricity that is mostly used across Iran to keep the lights on in the cities. So these were primarily civilian facilities. Now, the United States has clearly identified Israel as the party that carried out the attack on South Pars. I don't know who is claiming responsibility, if that is the right word, for the attack on Bushehr. Possibly it was Israel as well, but it might have been the United States. I simply do not know. But the United States, in public at least, is saying that it had no part in this attack on the South Pars gas field. Prior to the attack on the South Pars gas field, the state of Qatar had repeatedly warned against attacks on the South Pars gas field. It said that such attacks would be extraordinarily dangerous, that they would amount to a dangerous escalation. Israel, or at least Axios, American magazine, news magazine, which is known to have close connections to Israel, Axios is saying that the United States, in fact, was fully informed by Israel before the attack on South Pars took place. So there is a difference. The Americans are saying one thing, the Israelis are saying something completely different. And that is a sign of recrimination, and we will see shortly why this is so. Now, the President of the United States has Donald Trump. He's launched himself into this. He has published a Truth Social post, another one in the very incoherent series of Truth Social posts that he has now been publishing regularly ever since this conflict began. He says that he said in it that the United States was not informed in advance by Israel of the South Pass, of the attack on the South Pass gas field. He made it clear that he strongly disapproves of this attack. He has warned Israel not to conduct further attacks of that kind. But then, having warned the Israelis not to conduct attacks on the South Pass gas field, and having insisted that the United States and he personally were not informed about the attack on South Pass, he somewhat undercut, at least to my mind, his protestations of non-involvement by proceeding in the same Truth Social post to threaten enormous devastating consequences on Iran if they reciprocated with attacks on energy installations across the Persian Gulf. And he specifically gave an indication that one of the attacks, one of these devastating American attacks, would indeed be against the South Pars gas field. Well, the Iranians, perhaps unsurprisingly, paid no attention. They have said that, as far as they're concerned, this is a massive escalation. This is an attack, a direct attack, on an energy production facility. And they responded shortly after, ignoring, rejecting Donald Trump's warning. And there has been an attack on the natural gas extraction and liquefaction facilities in Qatar. And there are reports that the attack, which appears to have been conducted with both drones and missiles, did extensive damage. The Qatari authorities are apparently dismayed by the damage that has been done. And Iranian attacks on energy facilities across the Middle East continue. There have been attacks, apparently, this morning on energy production facilities in Kuwait. There's been attacks on energy facilities in Saudi Arabia, including, I believe, close to the capital, to Riyadh. And there have been reports, scattered reports, not always easy to make much sense of, and must be extremely careful about information that's coming about this conflict because of the heavy fog of war that always exists. But there's been scattered reports of attacks on the port on the Red Sea through which the Saudis have been trying to export the oil they cannot export through the Strait of Hormuz. And, well, something else has happened as well, because over the course of the last 24 hours, the Iranian Navy, which Donald Trump a few days ago confidently told us had been completely destroyed. Pete Hegseth, by the way, said much the same. Anyway, the Iranian Navy has been in action. Iranian speedboats have been operating in the Persian Gulf, and they have carried out attacks, apparently, on several tankers in the Persian Gulf. And, well, I'm not clear yet as to the exact level of damage that's been done to the tankers, but I've heard that it is, in fact, again, extensive. So this has created global shockwaves. Up to now, the energy markets have been remarkably complacent, I would say, about this crisis. They've been accepting the constant assurances from the administration that this will soon be over, that the United States will be able to either reopen the Strait of Hormuz, or they'll be able to escort tankers through the Strait of Hormuz, or they have already escorted a tanker through the Strait of Hormuz, all of those stories. The financial markets have been stable as well. They too appear to be accepting the assurances, the reassurances, that this is a temporary crisis, that it will soon all be over, that the situation will return to normal very soon. Now that the energy facilities are being attacked across the Middle East, that complacency has gone. There's been surges in the price of oil, much bigger surges in the price of natural gas. And bear in mind that in Europe, the state of the natural gas reserves is very low, unusually low for this time of year. So demand for natural gas is going to intensify. Anyway, there's been a surge in energy prices, and for the first time, financial markets are responding and they're starting to tumble, or at least they were as of the time when I started making this program. Now, in response to all of this, and despite the rising inflationary pressures, so far central banks are apparently messaging that they intend to keep interest rates at current levels. Again, this, I would suggest, reflects the mood of crisis. Normally, when there are stops in energy supply, and not just energy supply, because all sorts of other important products are now shipped through the Strait of Hormuz, which cannot be supplied any longer to global markets. Anyway, normally when an inflation shock of the scale that we might be looking at might be coming, you would expect central banks to increase interest rates to at least try to contain the inflation. But apparently, the central banks have looked at the situation. They sense that the situation in the financial markets is dangerously fragile. They are obviously aware that there are already recession indicators in Europe and perhaps even in the United States, and they were already starting to, they were already there before this conflict began. And for that reason, they are keeping interest rates where they are. In fact, at least in Britain, there's been a whole series of articles appearing in the British media warning, or perhaps the more correct word would be pleading, with the Bank of England not to raise interest rates in the face of this crisis, that doing so would crash the economy and the financial markets in London and could potentially create a massive fiscal crisis for the government as well. Now, that is all very well, and maybe it is the correct decision. I'm not here to say that it is, and I'm not here to say that it is not. But the potential risk of keeping interest rates steady in the face of these accumulating pressures is that inflation will surge and become embedded, as of course it did recently following the pandemic, when the banks, the central banks, as is now, I think, widely acknowledged, were too slow in raising interest rates, even as the Biden administration was increasing spending, and even as energy supplies were disrupted, though on a far smaller scale than what we are seeing now, because of the sanctions war that the Western powers recklessly and without proper foresight or consultation launched in February 2022 against Russia. So we are now, it seems to me, on the brink of a free-for-all. Saudi Arabia has been making warnings that if the Iranians continue their attacks on Saudi energy facilities, Saudi Arabia may have no choice but to join the war against Iran. Though what Saudi Arabia can add to this war over and above and beyond what Israel and the United States are doing is not obvious to me. Obviously, Saudi bases closer to Iran could be used, but the Iranians have been attacking those bases, and I wonder whether the Americans and the Israelis would want to use those bases. And I wonder whether the Saudi Air Force, large as it is, would be really in a position to continue to operate from those bases. Incidentally, the American media is now acknowledging the extraordinary destruction of the American radar systems across the Middle East, which took place in the early days of this conflict, and which I've discussed extensively in previous programs on this channel. I saw an admission that at least 10 important American radar systems have been destroyed. The cost of this, by the way, would be, of replacing them, would be in billions, given the size and complexity of some of these radar systems. But anyway, the point is that Saudi Arabia joining the war might not make a huge difference to the actual military calculus. And in fact, there are enormous risks, because if Saudi Arabia becomes involved in the war, then the Iranians no longer have to accept on themselves any restraints or inhibitions about attacking the very vulnerable Saudi oil facilities across the Middle East. They could attack the port on the Red Sea. They could attack the pipelines, the pipeline that sends the oil to this port, or they could get their, they could ask their friends, the Houthis, to do it for them. The Houthis, who have had a long history of conflict with Saudi Arabia, might entirely be entirely willing to join in, just to say. That, of course, would deepen the potential crisis in the energy industries still further. And lurking in the background, there is the extraordinary danger of reciprocal attacks, as between Iran, the Gulf states, and Israel on the desalination plants. Now, I have looked into this question in some detail. All of these countries, Iran, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, use desalination plants to provide, to maintain supplies of fresh water. But Iran, which is a mountainous, heavily forested country, is the least dependent. Apparently, only around 2% of Iran's fresh water is produced from desalination plants. Whereas in the case of Saudi Arabia, especially in the case of inland cities like Jeddah and Riyadh, and obviously also some of the Gulf cities as well, and significant towns and cities in Israel as well. Desalination plants and technology are essential for maintaining supplies of fresh water. Now, if the desalination plants are attacked, again, I'm not an engineer. I don't know how resilient these would be against attacks of these kind of this kind. It may be that the desalination plants can be repaired quickly and brought back into operation very fast. Or, of course, it might be otherwise. One should not assume that in the Middle East it is possible to repair facilities as quickly as they can be repaired in, say, Russia and Ukraine, as we have seen over the course of the war there. And of course, if there are interruptions in desalination, if cities start to run up shortages of fresh water, that is an appalling humanitarian crisis, one I don't even want to contemplate the consequences of. At its worst, one can imagine, frankly, apocalyptic scenes. And, well, if we are into a situation where cities, say like Riyadh, have to be evacuated, one wonders what that will do to the stability of the states of the Gulf states, which must already be worrying about their long-term future in light of the battering that they're getting and of the fact that the Strait of Hormuz remains closed. So I have provided a fairly detailed description, by my standards, of the events of the last 24 hours. And I think this is essential in order to understand the scale of the events that took place and the tipping point that these events might represent. No doubt, doubtless, there will be all sorts of people trying to talk up the importance of de-escalation. The French President Emmanuel Macron, who can always be relied upon to make an entirely empty gesture at a time of crisis. Anyway, he's come out and demanded a ceasefire. The Iranians have paid absolutely no attention, and nor have the Israelis. I don't get the sense that there is any negotiations of any kind taking place between any of the parties at the moment. Nobody is talking to anybody else. And going back to the killing of Larijani 2 days ago, this is completely unsurprising. The Iranians must worry that if they come out and start talking to the Americans and to the Israelis, given what has happened, they're only setting themselves up for death. And besides, they must be asking themselves who in their senses would want to negotiate with the Americans and the Israelis now, after all that has happened. And of course, that is exactly what the Iranians publicly are saying. So there are outside parties hovering in the background. There's the Russians, whom I'll come to in a moment. There's probably the Chinese too. China has good relations with Saudi Arabia and Iran. Russia has good relations with Saudi Arabia and Iran. In theory, the Chinese and the Russians could act as communicators or mediators. But for the moment at least, I don't get the sense that any kind of serious dialogue or discussion is taking place. Now, the other thing to say is that if we get into the kind of situation that I'm talking about, the destruction of energy facilities across the Middle East, the possible destruction of desalination plants, then what we're talking about is the destruction of the Persian Gulf region, of that part of the Middle East. Given its critical importance to the global economy, if we see an economic collapse there, if we see a political collapse there, that will almost certainly mean that energy flows and other flows of this region will stop, and that will have a massive effect on the global economy. It will also mean that financial flows from this region stop. The Gulf producers and the Saudis, since the 1970s, have played a critical role in keeping the global financial system functioning. They receive huge sums of money for the oil and other products that they export through the Strait of Hormuz, and they recycle some of the profits from this money through the financial system, which plays a critically important role in keeping the financial system running. Of course, if we go back to the 1970s, one of the factors that stabilized the financial situation then and established the reserve currency status of the dollar was Saudi Arabia's agreement, not just on its own behalf, but as the main OPEC producer, on behalf of OPEC, to receive exclusively payments in US dollars for oil, which, as I've discussed in many programs, immediately meant that every country around the world which had to import oil was obliged to hold dollars, oil being the world's most important and widely traded commodity, and the fact that everybody therefore needed to have dollars in order to buy oil, that played a central role in stabilizing the reserve currency status of the dollar and creating the dollar system that emerged out of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s. So potentially the events that we're seeing take place, as I said, are colossal. And that isn't even looking at the geopolitical consequences of all of this, which I will probably have to discuss in a different program. No wonder we are now finally seeing, both in energy markets and in financial markets, growing anxiety, which is reflected in the falls in the financial markets and in the rises in energy prices that have taken place over the last 24 hours. So why did we get here? Given that all of that I've just described was entirely plausible, there was a real possibility that some of this would eventually happen. Why has it happened? Well, I'm going to suggest that the reason it has happened is not actually that difficult to understand. When Israel and the United States launched this war against Iran on the 28th of February, they assumed, they believed that the Iranian government was weak and brittle, that the political structures in Iran were unpopular and discredited and delegitimized, not just by the suppression of the January protests, but by the many economic difficulties and other difficulties that Iran has faced over the last 10, 20 years. And the assumption seems to have been that following the death of the supreme leader and of his close ring of officials, there would be a power vacuum in Iran, that the country would become destabilized, and that regime change would follow, and that it would follow very fast. As my colleague and friend Alex Cristoforo repeatedly points out, the President of the United States has described the military campaign that the United States and Israel launched against Iran as a little excursion, which probably reflects closely what the president assumed it would be. In fact, I remember how before the conflict began, when there were reports that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, was nervous and was advising the president that it might not be easy to achieve some of the objectives, such as regime change, through attacking Iran, that the president expected. I remember that the president responded by publishing a Truth Social post in which he said that General Kane was fully on board, was a full member of the team, and that in the event that there would be an attack on Iran, the military campaign would be easy. Well, it has turned out entirely otherwise. We're now well into the third week of the war. The conflict goes on. Endless predictions that Iran was running out of missiles and drones have so far proved untrue. Indeed, I believe that over the last 24 hours, as you might expect, the rate of launches of Iranian missile and drones has actually increased. And I notice that we are not hearing any more reports about the extraordinary success that Israel and the United States had supposedly achieved in destroying Iranian missile launches. Somehow, in some way, that whole narrative appears to have faded, at least for the moment. And, well, the appearance of the Iranian speedboats, the attacks on the tankers in the Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz, in the Persian Gulf, what they also show is that that part of Iran's navy, be it its conventional navy or the part of the navy that is controlled by the IRGC, contrary to the many claims, still remains functional, at least to some degree, and is able to continue operations. So, faced with this, faced also with the fact that Iran has closed the Strait of Hormuz, has created this enormous disruption in global energy markets, that options to force the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz through military action appear, for the moment at least, to be, frankly, unviable, and that the Iranians are refusing all proposals for a temporary ceasefire and are now clearly making demands for the closure of American bases in the Middle East, for Iran to be acknowledged to have the right to enrich uranium to whatever level it chooses. Faced by these extraordinary demands, faced, in other words, by Iranian demands that would be construed both in Israel and the United States as a demand for the US and Israel to accept a public and very humiliating defeat, it is not surprising, perhaps, that the hardliners in both of these countries, in Israel and the United States, have embarked on a course of escalation instead. And, well, here again, we see events repeating themselves, because just as the United States apparently did not anticipate the strength of Iran's reaction or its resilience in the face of the initial attack on the 28th of February, so the United States and Israel also appear to have failed to anticipate the strength of Iran's reaction to the attacks on Bushehr, the nuclear power plant at Bushehr, but above all on the gas field at South Pars. So they went ahead and did those things, perhaps thinking to themselves that, especially with Larijani gone, attacks of this kind would frighten and intimidate the Iranians into agreeing to a ceasefire, which I suspect is the proximate American-Israeli objective. And that's why we saw the escalation that we have seen. Now, in saying all of this, I suppose one must address the American denials about American knowledge or foreknowledge of the Israeli attack on the South Pars gas field. Now, I'm going to say straight away that I do not know who is telling the truth here, whether it's the Israelis who insist that the Americans were informed or the Americans who are denying that they were informed. But I'm going to set out my own opinion, which is that I find it extraordinarily difficult to believe, despite the president's denials, that the United States did not know that an attack on the South Pars gas field would happen, that they were not informed by the Israelis or consulted about it in advance. It seems to me that, as happens so often, when something is done and then it turns out to be a disaster, it begins to go appallingly wrong. The party that can tries to distance itself from the mess. Probably the president himself didn't directly speak to Prime Minister Netanyahu about it, and that gives him some degree of plausible deniability. But there are plenty of US officials in Israel. They must be deeply involved in the planning process, or at any rate, I assume that they are. And I cannot believe that none of them knew anything about this. If I am wrong, if it is indeed the case that the Israelis acted on their own, then frankly, in some respects, it gets even worse, because it means that the United States has, in that case, completely lost control of the war, even though it is one of the main parties in the war. The course of events is no longer being dictated by the United States and by the president and by his officials, but by others, by the Israelis in this case, by the Iranians in other respects. The United States is simply being pulled along. I find that very difficult to believe myself, and that's why I continue to believe that the Americans were involved in advance. I would add that the president and his officials have acted throughout this term of Donald Trump's presidency in ways anyway that makes it very, very difficult for me to believe that they are telling the truth on any single matter. We've had, after all, the grotesque charade of the negotiations between Witkoff and Araghchi. I have no doubt, and in fact the media itself has said, that those negotiations were basically a cover for preparing an attack on Iran, which is the attack that we have seen. The president has, on several occasions, suggested that he wanted a peace settlement with Iran, but it never seemed to me that he was really negotiating to that end, certainly not after the June 2025 12-day war. And I'm afraid, given that history, given that complete lack of credibility, I don't see why I should believe the president or his officials on this issue either. Now, here we are. What is going to happen? It may be that the Iranians, having launched these attacks on the energy complex across the Gulf, will say that they've now done enough and that the moment has come for them to stop and to rely upon the restraint that to rely upon the deterrent that they perhaps hope that they have established. I have to say, on the contrary, that I strongly get the feeling that what we are far more likely to see is further escalation. Again, a few hours before I started making this program, reports appeared in the United States that President Trump, unable to negotiate a deal with the Iranians that he could sell as a victory, obviously unwilling to accept Iranian terms, unable to accept Iran's rejection of the temporary ceasefire idea, which is, I think, what he probably is hoping for. Anyway, I read that President Trump, his officials, at least Reuters is saying, that they're now rushing further larger numbers of ground troops to the Middle East, and that very soon, within a few days, they will be going back to Congress to ask for a $200 billion appropriation to continue the war. Now, notice that we are already getting constantly shifting figures about the true cost of the war up to this time. Just a few days ago, or so it seems to me, there was word of a $60 billion appropriation. That has now increased to $200 billion. $1 billion as against the US defense budget of $800 billion. We are already heading to the stratosphere in terms of costs. The war is only into its third week. One wonders how far this will go. The Intercept, a magazine which I think overall is reliable, but which needs to be treated with great care. I mean, their hostility to Trump is very long-standing, and in my opinion, has affected much of their previous reporting. Anyway, The Intercept has reminded us that when the Bush administration launched its invasion of Iraq in 2003, they said that they expected that the cost would be $40 billion, which would quickly recoup itself through the successful exploitation of Iraq's oil fields. And of course, there's no final figure for the full cost, economic and otherwise, of the Iraq war. But Joseph Stiglitz, The Economist, some years ago, published a book which is there in one of those shelves, in which he spoke about a $1 trillion war. That might have been an overstatement, though, to be frank, I doubt that it was. So it could be that this $200 billion request is just going to go on increasing. This against a backdrop of rising inflation, rising energy costs, all sorts of economic pressures, and of course, an ever-widening budget deficit. Anyway, the other thing to say about this $200 billion appropriation is that it is all very well, but you cannot win a war, or at least I would have thought that you cannot win a war unless you develop a plan on how, as to how you are going to win it. And the fact that we are now seeing troops being called in, and if we are looking at a ground operation, that is probably going to take months to put together. And I cannot imagine that in the case of a ground operation, even this administration will be able to carry it out without some sort of request for authorization from Congress. Just saying. Anyway, even if you get all the ground troops there, even if you sort out all of the logistics, even if you do all of the various other things that are needed, you still need to explain what your plan. Still need to have a plan which can deliver you something that you can call victory. And what is the plan? Is it to open the Strait of Hormuz by force? Is it to capture Harg Island? I've discussed in previous programs the enormous difficulties in doing any of these things in the face of Iranian opposition. Is it to march on Tehran? Something which would require probably not hundreds of thousands of troops, but well in excess of 1 million of them, and even that might not be enough. What is the plan? In a program that Alex and I did, which will appear in a few days on GB News in Britain, I made the point that there are some really very troubling similarities here with the conflict in Vietnam. In Vietnam, as we now know, the United States in the early 1960s took a decision to intervene in Vietnam. But at no point Did it ever come up with a strategy to achieve a military and political victory? So President Johnson first sent advisers, and then sent more advisers, and then sent ground troops, and then sent more ground troops, and the need to go on sending more and more ground troops continued, but there was never any clear, well thought out plan as to what all of these troops would actually do, which would deliver a conclusive victory against the North Vietnamese for the United States. And I worry that we are looking at exactly the same process all over again. Some people call it mission creep. I think that is an extremely inappropriate description. There's nothing about this that resembles creep, just to say. I think it's quite likely that we will see a few thousand Marines, a few thousand paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne Division, and then we will see heavy infantry with tanks, and then we will see the National Guard being called in and National Guard divisions being deployed. We'll see all sorts of things of this kind, and it absolutely will not be creep, not in any meaningful sense. But if it happens, there is still the unresolved question of what all of these military deployments would be intended to achieve in order to bring about something that the United States could plausibly describe as a victory. Not peace with honour, which is what Richard Nixon came back with 6 years, well, almost 9 years actually, after the American troops started to be deployed in Vietnam in large numbers. But what this president, Donald Trump, who owns this crisis because he made the decisions, what this president can tell the American people and the world plausibly is a victory. And that there are doubts that this is achievable was made for me absolutely clear by congressional testimony given by the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. Now, Director Gabbard has come in for a great deal of criticism recently because she didn't follow the recent resignation of her deputy, the person who was in charge of counterintelligence within the US intelligence community. And in fact, there's been a great deal of criticism of Director Gabbard altogether ever since the start of operations against Iran in June 2025. I'm not here to comment about that criticism. I just want to make a specific point, also made in a program we made on the Duran, Alex Christoforou and I, by Alex, that if you pass Director Gabbard's comments to Congress, and it's not difficult to do. She was shifting the entire responsibility for the war, and indeed the blame for the war, on the President of the United States. She was going out of her way to say that it was his decision and his alone. He was provided with the information. He was given the advice. He had the right to make the decision. He came up with the assessments. He made the decision. And though as a loyal official of the United States government and of his administration. Tulsi Gabbard, the director Gabbard, accepts that. The fact remains that if anything goes wrong, the blame will fall squarely upon him. I have said in many, many programs that I am a grizzled warrior, a grizzled veteran of bureaucratic intrigues. And there is absolutely no doubt at all in my mind, listening and reading Director Gabbard's testimony, that she, at least, expects this conflict to go badly wrong, and that she's now in the business of protecting her reputation and distancing herself from the debacle to the very limited extent that she can. Anyway, there it is. That's where we are today. Now, here there is one very final point I want to make. There are a lot of people, who look at this terrible situation and who are already saying that the United States has lost and that Iran has won. Well, I think that we are now, in the 19th day of this conflict, or maybe the 20th, I'm not absolutely sure. But the fact remains that we are still at what I suspect, what I fear, is an early stage of the conflict. Iran has hit back. It is fighting hard. It clearly still has missiles. It clearly still has drones. The government is still in control. There is no sign of regime change. There is no reason to think that there will be regime change. But there is no business in human society as risky and as unpredictable as war. And given the imbalance of power between Iran and its adversaries, I would say that it is still too early to say, and I think this does need to be said, it is still too early to say that Iran has won and the United States has lost. And given that it is too early to say that, it is probably premature to try to assess the geopolitical outcomes of such an Iranian victory, given that it has not yet been achieved. Though I will say that those outcomes will be dramatic ones. However, I have to also say this. Again, as I've discussed in many programs on this channel, I do have a source who is able to glean information from Russia, from the messaging boards in the Russian parliament, the State Duma, which are not perhaps quite open access, but which are only lightly classified and which are, I have no doubt at all, read by the intelligence officials in the United States. Anyway, the gossip on these messaging boards appears to be that the Kremlin has informed the Duma that one of the things that Iran is probably going to need before long is stable supplies of food in order to keep the Iranian cities fed and in order to keep Iran functional. And apparently the members of the parliament have been asked by the Kremlin to come up with their ideas about how Iran's food security is to be achieved. Now, obviously, there is likely to be a certain humanitarian dimension to this. But of course, the Russians know perfectly well that if they start supplying Iran with food and other forms of economic assistance are likely to follow, and supplying Iran with food and with economic assistance, continuing, for example, to supply Iran with natural gas, which Russia, by the way, already does, but perhaps stepping up supplies of natural gas, well, that will create a situation in which Iran can continue this war. It will prolong the war, or it could prolong the war. And that is a factor that must also be borne in mind. It looks as if Iran is going to be given at least some of the help that it needs from its allies, from its friends, China, Russia, those countries, so that it can sustain the war over a long period. In which case, the problems that the United States and Israel already face, and which are faced by America's allies, the Gulf states, Japan, Europe, those problems inevitably are going to multiply. Now, here I'm going to say briefly, I'm going to round off by saying that this enormous surge in energy prices potentially has disastrous outcomes in Europe and in Japan and in South Korea. There are already multiple reports of growing energy shortages across Asia. The Chinese, to some extent, are insulated by their huge reserves. And of course, up to now, they've been able to import oil from Iran and perhaps Saudi Arabia too. But if there is a free-for-all and a campaign to destroy energy across the Middle East, that will end. But then the Chinese, more than anyone else, can also rely on secure supplies of oil and gas from Russia. And of course, there are already existing oil and gas pipelines between Russia and China, which can be supplemented by ship. So, Europe, Japan, in an appalling situation. You would have thought that the European leadership, I'm not going to talk about the Japanese leadership, about which I know little, but you would have thought that the European leadership would be extremely concerned about this situation and would be taking decisive and urgent steps to make its concerns known in Washington, but they have done absolutely nothing. There's no word, for example, of any European officials travelling to Tehran or of having meetings with the Iranians. There's no word of any European officials talking to the Israelis. Europe, as is so often the case, gives the impression of a rabbit caught in the headlights of an oncoming car. This has been the most serious and even more serious abdication of responsibility by the European political class to the nations of Europe than what we have seen in Ukraine. As a European, I have a heavy heart saying this, but however bad the quality of leadership in Europe seems to be they always contrive to prove that the reality is even worse. Anyway, that is all I'm going to say. The other conflict, the conflict in Ukraine, also, of course, continues. I'm not going to discuss it in any detail in this program, but I will say just a few very quick things. Firstly, yesterday, Peskov, Putin's spokesman, finally confirmed that the trilateral talks between the United States, Russia, and Ukraine have been indefinitely suspended. The bilateral discussions between Witkoff and Dmitriev continue, but to be honest, that looks to me more like a conversation about what might be than a serious negotiation about anything. I was invited to a virtual meeting along with most of the British media, including the mainstream media, held by the Russian embassy in London today. This is to discuss the Ukrainian attacks on Belgorod and the attacks that the Russians say have been carried out against the civilian population. I was provided with what I thought was stark and irrefutable evidence that those attacks have indeed taken place. And I am sorry to say, it looks to me that those attacks, quite in some cases at least, look to have been intentional. And if they were not, certainly the attacks were indiscriminate. I will discuss this further in another place. But again, the overall take I got from this briefing was that the Russians have come to the conclusion, to the clear conclusion, that given the nature of the regime in Kiev, what they call the regime in Kiev, given its attitudes towards Russia and towards Russians, coexistence with it in any form is impossible, and that its removal, regime change in other words, is the only way forward. Putin himself addressed a meeting of, from what I can remember, families of war veterans. When I say war veterans, I mean veterans of this particular war. I noticed that he spoke about the choice that the citizens of Crimea, the anniversary of the union of which this meeting was commemorating, Donbass, Zaporozhye and Kherson, to unite with Russia. There's been lots of rumours, lots of talk about how supposedly the Russians agreed to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions in return for the Ukrainians pulling out of Donbass. That was certainly not the impression I got from what Putin was saying. It seemed to me that in his mind, at least, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions in their entirety now are Russian and the Ukrainians must leave. Quite possibly, things will go beyond that over the course of the war. But for the moment, at least, there are no negotiations. It doesn't look as if there are going to be negotiations. With all the attention on the Middle East, with arms supplies to Ukraine having dried up completely, the Russians must feel very confident. And of course, their spring offensive is about to come. In fact, there is a certain amount of information that the cauldron made up of the Ukrainian troops in the Kupiansk area on the east bank of the Oskol River has now been finally extinguished with what appears to be video footage of Russian troops operating in the last remaining town that was located inside this cauldron. So the war will go on. The Russians increasingly confident that they're going to win. The same source that provided me with the information from the messaging boards in the Duma about proposals in Russia to feed Iran, to keep Iran fed through the ongoing crisis. That source says that the Russians are telling themselves that the arrival in Moscow in February, before the start of the conflict in Iran, of Macron's envoys, the ones who, well, Ushakov showed them the door, basically. Anyway, the Russians are taking these approaches from the Europeans, these attempts by the Europeans to initiate some sort of dialogue now, as a sign of weakness, and that makes them increasingly confident that the moment has come for them to redouble their efforts and to vigorously prosecute the war. Well, this is where I'm going to finish my program today. We'll see what happens in the Middle East over the next few hours and days. As I said, it does seem to me that a critical line has now been crossed. We'll see whether the leaders in the West, in the Middle East, have any answer to the problems that are now mounting. Thank you again. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Don't forget to check out our Substack site. Last but not least, please remember, if you like this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.